Chapter 24. From the Provider's Logbook. Bill of Fare, October 12th. Mulligatawny soup. Salt fish and egg sauce. Roast haunch of mutton. Boiled shoulder and onion sauce. Boiled beef. Roast fowls. Pilladiddo. Ham. Haricot mutton. Curry and rice. Cabbage. French beans. Boiled piados. Baked ditto. Damson tart. Rice puddings. Currant ditto. Currant fritters. We were just at the port's mouth, and could see the towers and buildings of Alexandria rising purple against the sunset, when the report of a gun came booming over the calm golden water, and we heard, with much mortification, that we had no chance of getting pratique that night. Already the ungrateful passengers had begun to tire of the ship, though in our absence in Syria it had been carefully cleansed and purified, though it was cleared of the swarming Jews who had infested the decks all the way from Constantinople, and though we had been feasting and carousing in the manner described above. But very early next morning we bore into the harbor, busy with a great quantity of craft. We passed huge black hulks of mouldering men of war, from the sterns of which trailed the dirty red flag, with the star and crescent. Boats, manned with red-capped seamen, and captains and steersmen in beards and tarbouches, passed continually among these old hulks, the rowers bending to their oars, so that at each stroke they disappeared bodily in the boat. Besides these, there was a large fleet of country ships, and stars and stripes, and tricolors, and Union Jacks, and many active steamers, of the French and English companies, shooting in and out of the harbor, or moored in the briny waters. The ship of our company, the Oriental, lay there a palace upon the brine, and some of the Pasha's steam vessels likewise, looking very like Christian boats. But it was queer to look at some unintelligible Turkish flourish painted on the stern, and the long-tailed Arabian hieroglyphics gilt on the paddle boxes. Our dear friend and comrade of Beirut, if we may be permitted to call her so, H.M.M.S. Trump, was in the harbor, and the captain of that gallant ship, coming to greet us, drove some of us on shore in his gig. I had been preparing myself overnight, by the help of a cigar and a moonlight contemplation on deck, for sensations on landing in Egypt. I was ready to yield myself up with solemnity to the mystic grandeur of the scene of initiation. Pompey's pillar must stand like a mountain, in a yellow plain, surrounded by a grove of obelisks as tall as palm trees. Placid sphinxes brooding o'er the Nile, mighty Memnonian countenances calm had revealed Egypt to me in a sonnet of Tennyson's, and I was ready to gaze on it with pyramidal wonder and hieroglyphic awe. The landing quay at Alexandria is like the dockyard quay at Portsmouth, with a few score of brown faces scattered among the population. There are slop sellers, dealers in marine stores, bottled porter shops, seamen lolling about. Flies and cabs are plying for hire, and a yelling chorus of donkey boys, shrieking, "Ride, sir! Donkey, sir! I say, sir!" In excellent English, dispel all romantic notions. The placid sphinxes brooding o'er the Nile disappeared with that shriek of the donkey boys. You might be as well impressed with Wapping as with your first step on Egyptian soil. The riding of a donkey is, after all, not a dignified occupation. A man resists the offer at first, somehow, as an indignity. How is that poor little, red-saddled, long-eared creature to carry you? Is there to be one for you, and another for your legs? Natives and Europeans, of all sizes, pass by, it is true, mounted upon the same contrivance. I waited until I got into a very private spot, where nobody could see me, and then ascended, why not say descended, at once, on the poor little animal. Instead of being crushed at once, as perhaps the rider expected, it darted forward, quite briskly and cheerfully, at 6 or 7 miles an hour, requiring no spur or admonitive to haste, except the shrieking of the little Egyptian gamin, who ran along by Asinus's side. The character of the houses by which you pass is scarcely Eastern at all. The streets are busy with a motley population of Jews and Armenians, slave-driving-looking Europeans, large-breeched Greeks, and well-shaven buxom merchants, looking as trim and fat as those on the bourse on change. Only, among the natives, the stranger can fail to remark, as the caliph did of the calendars in the Arabian Nights, that so many of them have only one eye. It is the horde of Thalmia which has played such frightful ravages with them. You see children sitting in the doorways, their eyes completely closed up with the green sickening sore, and the flies feeding on them. 5 or 6 minutes of the donkey ride brings you to the Frank Quarter, and the handsome broad street, like a street of Marseille, where the principal hotels and merchants' houses are to be found, and where the consuls have their houses, and hoist their flags. The palace of the French consul general makes the grandest show in the street, and presents a great contrast to the humble abode of the English representative, who protects his fellow countrymen from a second floor. But that Alexandrian two-pair front of a consulate was more welcome and cheering than a palace to most of us. For there lay certain letters, with postmarks of home upon them, and kindly tidings, the first heard for 2 months. Though we had seen so many men and cities since, that Cornhill seemed to be a year off, at least, with certain persons dwelling more or less in that vicinity. I saw a young Oxford man seize his dispatches, and slink off with several letters, written in a tight neat hand, and sedulously crossed, which any man could see, without looking farther, were the handiwork of Marianne, to whom he is attached. The lawyer received a bundle from his chambers, in which his clerk eased his soul regarding the state of Snooks v. Rogers, Smith at Tompkins, and C. The statesman had a packet of thick envelopes, decorated with that profusion of sealing wax in which official recklessness lavishes the resources of the country. And your humble servant got just one little modest letter, containing another, written in pencil characters, varying in size between 1 and 2 inches, but how much pleasanter to read than my lord's dispatch, or the clerk's account of Smith at Tompkins, yes, even than the Marianne correspondence. Yes, my dear madam, you will understand me when I say that it was from little Polly at home, with some confidential news about a cat, and the last report of her new doll. It is worth while to have made the journey for this pleasure, to have walked the deck on long nights, and have thought of home. You have no leisure to do so in the city. You don't see the heavens shine above you so purely there, or the stars so clearly. How, after the perusal of the above documents, we enjoyed a file of the admirable Galignani, and what O'Connell was doing, and the 12 last new victories of the French in Algeria, and, above all, 6 or 7 numbers of Punch. There might have been an avenue of Pompey's pillars within reach, and a live sphinx sporting on the banks of the Mahmoudia Canal, and we would not have stirred to see them, until Punch had had his interview and Galignani was dismissed. The curiosities of Alexandria are few, and easily seen. We went into the bazaars, which have a much more eastern look than the European quarter, with its Anglo-Gallic-Italian inhabitants, and Babel-like civilization. Here and there a large hotel, clumsy and whitewashed, with oriental trellised windows, and a couple of slouching sentinels at the doors, in the ugliest composite uniform that ever was seen, was pointed out as the residence of some great officer of the Pasha's court, or of one of the numerous children of the Egyptian Solomon. His Highness was in his own palace, and was consequently not visible. He was in deep grief, and strict retirement. It was at this time that the European newspapers announced that he was about to resign his empire, but the quidnuncs of Alexandria hinted that a love affair, in which the old potentate had engaged with senile extravagance, and the effects of a potion of hashish, or some deleterious drug, with which he was in the habit of intoxicating himself, had brought on that languor and desperate weariness of life and governing, into which the venerable prince was plunged. Before 3 days were over, however, the fit had left him, and he determined to live, and reign a little longer. A very few days afterwards, several of our party were presented to him at Cairo and found the great Egyptian ruler perfectly convalescent. This, and the opera, and the quarrels of the two prime don, and the beauty of one of them, formed the chief subjects of conversation, and I had this important news in the shop of a certain barber in the town, who conveyed it in a language composed of French, Spanish, and Italian, and with a volubility quite worthy of a barber of Il Blas. Then we went to see the famous obelisk presented by Mehemet Ali to the British government, who have not shown a particular alacrity to accept this ponderous present. The huge shaft lies on the ground, prostrate, and desecrated by all sorts of abominations. Children were sprawling about, attracted by the dirt there. Arabs, Negroes, and donkey boys were passing, quite indifferent, by the fallen monster of a stone as indifferent as the British government, who don't care for recording the glorious termination of their Egyptian campaign of 1801. If our country takes the compliment so coolly, surely it would be disloyal upon our parts to be more enthusiastic. I wish they would offer the Trafalgar Square pillar to the Egyptians, and that both of the huge ugly monsters were lying in the dirt there side by side. Pompey's pillar is by no means so big as the Charing Cross trophy. This venerable column has not escaped ill treatment either. Numberless ships' companies, traveling cockneys, and sea, have affixed their rude marks upon it. Some daring ruffian even painted the name of Aaron's Blacking upon it, effacing other inscriptions. One, Wilkinson says, of the second Semeticus. I regret deeply, my dear friend, that I cannot give you this document respecting a lamented monarch, in whose history I know you take such an interest. The best sight I saw in Alexandria was a Negro holiday, which was celebrated outside of the town by a sort of Negro village of huts, swarming with old, lean, fat, ugly, infantine, happy faces, that nature had smeared with a preparation even more black and durable than that with which Semeticus's base has been polished. Every one of these jolly faces was on the broad grin, from the dusky mother to the india rubber child sprawling upon her back, and the venerable Jetty Senior whose wool was as white as that of a sheep in Florian's pastorals. To these dancers a couple of fellows were playing on a drum and a little banjo. They were singing a chorus, which was not only singular and perfectly marked in the rhythm, but exceeding sweet in the tune. They danced in a circle, and performers came trooping from all quarters, who fell into the round, and began waggling their heads, and waving their left hands, and tossing up and down the little thin rods which they each carried, and all singing to the very best of their power. I saw the chief eunuch of the Grand Turk at Constantinople pass by. Here is an accurate likeness of his beautiful features, too, but with what a different expression. Though he is one of the great in the Turkish Empire, ranking with a cabinet minister or Lord Chamberlain here, his fine countenance was clouded with care, and savage with ennui. Here his black brethren were ragged, starving, and happy, and I need not tell such a fine moralist as you are, how it is the case, in the white as well as the black world, that happiness, republican leveler, who does not care a fig for the fashion, often disdains the turrets of kings, to pay a visit to the Abernus Pauperum. We went the round of the coffee houses in the evening, both the polite European places of resort, where you get ices and the French papers, and those in the town, where Greeks, Turks, and general company resort, to sit upon uncomfortable chairs, and drink wretched muddy coffee, and to listen to two or three miserable musicians, who keep up a variation of howling for hours together. But the pretty song of the niggers had spoiled me for that abominable music. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.